Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
There's a lot of trials going on right now. When it rains, it pours, right? This year has been rather slow on trials, but now we have three big ones happening at the same time. The Lindsey Clancy trial, getting close to wrapping up. We're going to talk about that first and some of the revelations that have been made in the last 48 hours in just a moment. Also, the Jared Bridegain murder trial. That's really three trials in one, or three separate trials, truly, for the one person. Right now, Mario Fernandez Saldana on trial. That's the husband of Jared's ex-wife that she married, who's accused of being involved in his demise, and also 30 years in the making, the trial for the murder of Tupac Shakur. We're going to go into the latest on all of that today. Your thoughts in the comments section, drop them there, and we're going to do our best to try and answer your questions as we work through a lot of Q&As today on the program. Let's get into this. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, notes. My co-host, with me as always. And
look at these notes, all these cases. Look what I got to do to try to keep you, these names straight.
it's a little homework, you know, but once you get them ingrained in your mind, then you just wake up in the middle of the night in hot sweats going, oh my God.
Well, yeah. You know, we've been so absorbed in the Lindsey Clancy case that my entire brain has been just nothing but this. And then we got these other cases, like you said, that have popped up, and we've covered one of them pretty extensively. Yeah. So I literally had to go back in and repopulate my brain with all these other, hopefully it all keeps organized as it comes out. If I refer to my notes throughout, sure. I apologize. Hey,
it's
I have wire diagrams.
I think it's fair to say the amount of cases we cover, if one of us catches the other confusing a fact from another, go ahead and say it out loud. I did it the other day. I was talking about one of the cases, and I mixed up the attorneys that worked out of the mortuary, or out of the crematorium, which is, in fact, that's Donna Adelson's attorneys, right. And I mixed them with someone else's. I forgot whose. But I'm like, they work out of a crematorium, and I was completely wrong. But,
and I don't know how you do it. I'm only with you an hour a day, but you create content on all these other cases all day, and I have no idea how you keep.
I
it
do
straight.
My best. It's a lot of trying to keep notes straight, and AI certainly helps me with that. But I think I broke mine. I go off the rails all the time, so I'm relying on my memory, which is not always the greatest. But anyway, let's jump into this. We're going to go over a lot of the questions here, a lot of the stuff you guys have been dropping in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, please do check out our YouTube channel and hit subscribe. And then drop your comments in there. These are some of them. Some of these things we've talked about with other experts amongst ourselves, but they're still being asked. And I thought, well, let's do our best to try and dive into it. The prosecution just rested in the Lindsey Clancy trial. 14 days of testimony. The jury heard her husband's 911 call. They walked through the house on Summer Street on a field trip, basically, with the jury. They watched her sob while doctors described trying to save her three children. And now the defense has started calling witnesses. Her mother, people who knew her, and they're all saying the same thing. She was a loving mom who was drowning and couldn't get anyone to hear her. You've seen it in her own writings, in her own diaries. It's all consistent. This is a woman who was begging for help, wanting to feel like herself. The question that's ripping this audience apart hasn't changed since January 23. If she was that sick, how did she plan it that carefully? That's what a lot of people are asking. And let's try and get into it. I think there's flaws in the question itself. and it seems a lot of them seem to hover around the psychosis and the understanding of psychosis. And if you're just joining us, if you haven't seen the piece that we did with Siobhan earlier in the week or last week about the difference between someone who is psychotic and someone who's in a state of psychosis, go watch it. That will explain a lot more to you about what it is, because it's a fundamental understanding of what the two actually are. They are very different things. The question we have, her first psychiatrist, the one who had 14 telehealth sessions with her, the one that was talking about the drop-down menus, Tufts, said she never seemed psychotic. That's, a qualifying question that isn't necessarily applicable to the situation at that moment, but when presented a certain way, can imply something. If the person literally treating your mind doesn't see it, how is a jury supposed to believe it was there? Megan on Instagram asked that question. I'll let you go, Robin. Go.
Yeah, it's first we have to have our minds open to understanding what a psychotic break is. And that's where we have to do our research. We have to listen to the mental health experts that are experts in psychosis and psychotic breaks. You know, again, go back and listen to Siobhan's episode, actually a few of them with us.
Yeah.
Extremely insightful, as well as the other experts out there. People are saying that there's a lot of mental health experts online that are commenting that this isn't true. They don't believe it. No, I've only found one that believes that. So it's first understanding what a psychotic break is and actually how it ebbs and flows from being prevalent and not prevalent. So in this case also, when Tufts was seeing her, she wasn't in a psychotic break.
Yeah.
Because she just wasn't, because it wasn't prevalent yet. It was starting to manifest. Again, I am not a clinician. I'm just a layman like everyone else watching, observing the behaviors along this. But the signs were there that were heading in that direction. She had postpartum depression multiple times. And I'm going to keep referring back a few times because a lot of people keep making reference to Andrea Yates, because Andrea Yates, a number of years ago, was found not guilty by reason of insanity for exactly the same thing. Offing her 4 children instead of 3, roughly exactly the same ages, and her diagnosis of psychosis was postpartum psychosis. Everyone was saying it was made years ahead. No, it was made 15 months ahead of her final act of killing her kids. So there's a lot of comparisons here. They did not diagnose it early on in her as well. It was only after her S attempt on her 3rd child that it started coming prevalent. So the same thing's going on here. Just Lindsay's a little behind it. And also, the way psychosis manifests in different patients and different human beings is going to be different. But here's some overlaps that Tufts was missing and everyone was screaming at and missing that Siobhan picked up on. And that was the insomnia and the sleep deprivation, which brought on mania. And when the mania started escalating worse, with then you throw more kerosene on the fire with prescriptions in, out, up, down, 13 different ones. I mean, it's a tremendous soup of someone that was just trying to get help and no one was listening to her, as Siobhan pointed out and everyone pointed out. So how does it get missed? How did she not see it? The psychosis wasn't manifest yet. It was on its way. And she missed the red flags. That's what the claim is here. She missed the red flags along the way because she didn't have experience. She didn't have someone to bounce the ideas off of that she's supposed to, or that other experts are saying that, you know, you have, after you meet with a client, you have a confab afterwards and you say, hey, here's what I'm seeing. What are your thoughts? Where should I go next?
I have a lot of problem with that question, and I get irked by it every time I hear it asked. It was just the structure of it, because it assumes something that's not reality. It assumes that it was there to be caught.
Right, wasn't.
It wasn't even there to be caught yet. If every year, here's an example. We'll do a totally different type of diagnosis here. Every year, I tend to get bronchitis at some point in time. The first time I had it, I didn't know I was going to be getting it, but I tend to get it usually fall or spring, one or the other. But if I go to my doctor and I don't quite have bronchitis yet, I'm not going to get treated for bronchitis. I'm going to get treated for something else. Now, bronchitis, you know, it can come on then later on once it's built up enough and you're in that state. But I'm not necessarily going to be treated for bronchitis 3 months before I develop it or a month before I develop it. It's not there yet. Once it hits and you got to treat it. You can do things ahead of time to maybe circumvent you from getting there, which would have been helpful if they had diagnosed her correctly with bipolar and not generalized anxiety disorder, not given her the exact opposite medications of what one should be getting for her diagnosis. That would have been nice, but it wasn't. But you can't treat something that's not presenting itself yet. Mm-hmm. And because it's not presenting itself a month early or 2 months early or 3 months early, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Just the same way when I actually do get the bronchitis coming on and I got to take what I need to take for it, an inhaler and shit, doesn't mean that they didn't catch that 3 months earlier, so you don't have it. You're making all that up. You're just taking that inhaler for fun, aren't you? You're just putting on a show. You're just coughing uncontrollably because you want attention. That's essentially what people are saying about Lindsay Clancy when they're saying that her falling into a state of psychosis, that it's all just, you know, kerfuffery. It's not even a word, but I mean, it is now. It's all bullshit because it didn't present and it wasn't diagnosable 2 or 3 months ahead of time.
And the planning,
it's not
too
hard to figure out. I mean, it's not a hard argument to make, and it's not a hard one to understand. It's a matter of accepting it, I guess.
And the planning also is a big part of that question, a big part of what everyone's having a hard time with is that, well, how can she plan this? You know, she must just be this evil person because if she's in psychosis, you know, how come she planned it out? Yes, part of
what did she plan out, though? I mean, I know people are like stuck in that she's planning this shit out. Where are we seeing she's planning shit out? Because she looked up how to end her own life. I mean,
right.
that's
a couple
of
Google searches, you know, for timing between him going to the restaurant to get dinner and things like so. All right. So, and regardless of whether you believe it was planned for 24 hours before or not, again, psychotic breaks ebb and flow out. Yeah. Matter of fact, I was just watching. They had only one testimony this morning as of this recording on the 20th. They had only one witness on the stand this morning. It was her pastor that came to her as just a sign it was actually in her hospital and saw her multiple times. And this is the very first one that said the very first words out of Lindsay's mouth after a couple of days of being incubated and then finally removed the breathing tube from her. And this is a couple days after the event of her killing her kids. The first words out of her mouth were this: "Are my children safe?" And the pastor said, yes, they're safe. And she gave a religious reference about how they're safe with God and everything. Mm-hmm. And then Lindsay talked about how the command voice told her the only way for them to be safe is for me to kill them and then to kill myself. So in other words, the point of this is saying that even a couple days after this, the psychosis hadn't ebbed off yet. So she was still in psychosis. And so how do you plan in psychosis? How can that manifest? Well, otherwise, she's having normal conversations. It's layered on top of, it's intertwined like this, and so you can actually function and look like a completely normal human being. But when you add a psychotic break, it's not schizophrenia where all of a sudden you're a new person. No, this is completely integrated into it. And so the integration of this command voice is what claimed, again, guilty, innocent until proven guilty here, although she claims full responsibility for the horror of her children, which is another thing that we do, is it's okay, people, to hold two truths at the same time. The truth of the horror of that she murdered her children, at the same time you can hold the truth that she was in a psychotic break and the mental health system failed her on this one. You can hold both at the same time. It's okay. And that's what people are having a hard time with. So that shows a level of distinction, of understanding, hopefully, of how these two things can coexist together.
You need to hold both things at the same time to truly understand and grasp them. Otherwise, you're not seeing the full picture of this case. I want to throw this one at you. I know I don't think it's on our list of questions, but I want to throw it in. The attorney, Big Bow Lady, the DA, the ADA, the mortal sin, mother and saying you are aware that murder is a mortal
in your sin. Religion.
What on earth was that about? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm glad the judge shut her down and shut her up, but where and why was that brought into this case? I don't know. I'm just like, wow, that's
I think all field. I think all they're able to do, since everyone's kind of saying exactly the same things on both sides, is just whether you believe it was like psychotic break or not. And so I think what I've been seeing the prosecutors do is they're trying to discredit people. And so I think what she was trying to do with Lindsay's mom, no, it wasn't a mom, it was a stepmother, not stepmother, yeah. Mother-in-law.
In-law, yeah.
Was to discredit her by putting her statements in conflict with each other. So how can you still stand behind Lindsay and support Lindsay and saying what a loving mother she is when in your own religion she committed a mortal sin? So I think she's probably trying to discredit her by conflicting statements on that. So I think that's the only thing she's going for.
Oh my God. I just was like, oh my God.
It hurt her. It hurt everyone again. You know, the prosecution, they keep stumbling on themselves with what they're attempting, because you see them unable to hold two truths at the same time.
Well, for the love of God, literally. Like, you're talking about a religion, and if we're going at its core tenets, you're talking about one that talks about understanding, that talks about forgiveness. Those are the core tenets here, not necessarily murder is the mortal sin and you shall burn forever for it. What are we doing here? I mean, at this point, should we just stone her? I mean, out in the courtyard? I mean, if she's going to be bringing this up, it's like, well, let's get out the rocks and bring her out back at the courthouse.
Can you even fathom the amount of empathy it takes and the relationships that Lindsay was able to form with all these people? For all of them, there's not one person, now think about this, there's not one person in her entire life that's ever known her, that's ever come out on social media, or it's been in the witness stand during this trial, that's ever stood against her. And for those people that say she's faking it, that she's pulling one over on us, I did the research. There's not one case in the history that I could research. Granted, if you can find one, post it. I'll research it because I entertain all. But there's not one case ever that I could find where someone was able to pull the wool over everyone's eyes, ever, to this degree. It just doesn't exist, because it would have had to have been preemptive, relationship building, all the way through. Because again, it's been 3 years, 4 years, going on four since the murders of her children. Yeah. Do you think when people have hindsight for that period of time, as they're going through mourning, as they're asking themselves, what ifs, what are the red flags I missed? What could I have done better? What could I have done differently? That they wouldn't have been able to pick up on a wobble in her of her pulling a ruse over. The only thing every single person has testified to was that she was crying out for help.
It must be a very lovely world to live in when you disagree with a fact or something that makes you uncomfortable, and the quick out is just simply stating that it's witchery. It's something she's just lying about it, and that's just the easy explanation, because you can move on with your day. I don't know. I feel bad for the people that the people in these folks' lives when something goes wrong. Because I don't know that these are the folks that I'd be relying on to be there for me if something goes horribly awry that doesn't necessarily follow a path of just everything's happy and rainbows. Because I don't know. Maybe it's different. Quite often it is when it applies in a personal level for a lot of folks versus watching this out there, you know, in the ether. It's almost entertaining.
And it's okay. I mean, it's probably why we're all so exhausted by this case, because there's been so many things put out there that I then research. And so say, and this is not a condemnation of absolutely anyone, but here's what you do differently. Here's what you can add to the things you're doing already. When you hear something like this, hold it, like we said, hold it and then investigate it. Try to prove it right. Seriously, just don't accept it at face value. Try to, if it's differing from what you think yourself, try to prove it right. If it's something that you thought of your own, try to prove it wrong. That's what we're talking. That is what really good, thoughtful, critical thinking does. You just hear something and you try to prove it. So I heard this so many times from so many other experts that it's a fakery. So you know what? I'm going to take it at face value. She's faking us out. Let me try to prove it.
Yeah.
There's no data that supports it. There's zero data that supports it, both her behaviorally, guaranteed, but also from past cases. Yeah. Just looking compared to past cases. That's why they do have things called case law, so that people can actually look at past cases, because past is always prologue to a lot of things in life. And in cases like this, even in rare cases, because remember, postpartum psychotic breaks and psychosis is 1 in 1,000. Yeah. Postpartum depression, 1 in 10. So people will often assume that if it must just been a really bad case of postpartum depression. No, those are a lot more common and they're a lot more manageable, although sometimes not as much, because again, we're seeing the failures time and time again with documentation, lack of consistency between providers, coordination between providers, the medical industry with the medications that she's, and there's so much gaps in this. And we talked to Siobhan yesterday about this, because people keep, the only other case that got this kind of notoriety was the Andrea Yates case. And they said they learned a lot from it, but have they really? Because exactly the same things are playing out and even worse on this one. And if you actually look at the parallels, there are, I did the comparison, there are more parallels with Lindsay's case and Andrew Yates' case than there are differences. The only difference was the diagnoses. And it's not because they missed it. It's because around the same time period, at the same number of birth of children, is exactly when it started exasperating in Lindsay as it did in Andrea Yates. Andrea Yates just had one more kid and then it actually went up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Research point.
I know. Look at you with those facts and truth.
Sorry.
I'll do one more on this. The statement, the question is saying, I had postpartum depression bad enough that I thought about driving off a bridge. I got help. I got better. The thing that terrifies me about this case isn't whether she's guilty. It's that she did ask for help and the system still failed her. If a jury acquits her, does that actually change anything for the next mom? Or does the system just keep running the same way? I think there it's two-pronged. And honestly, I think a lot more of it, because reality comes down to, well, what's going to be legislatively the rules for which a medical operation can operate within. So if this does change anything, and we'd have to get to some sort of legislative level of whatever needs to be changed, that will affect change within the medical system. But I honestly think more importantly is the civil cases, because when you start hitting them in the pocketbook and they start going, oh, this is a large liability for millions and millions of dollars, new protocols go in place, rules go in place, other safeguards go into place that would then hopefully protect the entities from lawsuits like this, because there are new and better standards in place for the practitioners operating under it. So there's different ways to affect the infrastructure of this, legislatively and monetarily. But as of right now, they really all were operating within the confines of what is allowed. But this is a case that certainly challenges it.
Yeah. It's interesting, as you're saying that, Tony, I'm reflecting and going through my own context, because our thoughts, opinions, and what we put out to the world is based on our own experiences, which is our own biases and confirmations and all those things. And so I have such little, even more so from doing a show with you, I have such little confidence that major things will be changed in organizations and institutions. I think they'll, you know, if they're litigated and there's money attached to it, they'll put a Band-Aid here and a Band-Aid here, and hopefully it'll get a little bit better over time. But, and here's why I'm saying the but, here's where I think the major things happen in cases like this. It's that village mentality. So here I am inside the FBI. I did not get good at doing my job because I had better legislation, I had better laws, I had better widgets, tools, and techniques I was using in the investigation itself in my little bubble inside here. My ability to be successful was my ability to rally a village and relationships around me that were loving critics that could lend thoughts, ideas, and opinions, objectives, tools, and their own techniques. And so in this case, what that references to me is this case has brought to light a few things. One, it takes a village. And it takes a village to recognize red flags. not just in a medical profession, but all friends and family, which I actually saw all the red flags, the courage to take a little bit more bolder action, you know, in this case, because if you don't have a context of what could go sideways, you're never going to assume it does. And I think that's exactly what was going on here. No one in her family understood, like none of us did until this case, the effects of insomnia, the effects of lack of sleep, the effects of all these things. And so all the red flags were there that we all now know more about. And so others, so people in our lives, even if the medical system hasn't successfully fixed this problem, and also it's going to be jurisdiction dependent, it's going to be resource dependent, different areas around the country. So some place might get really good. Some place is going to continue to suck, you know, in the hills of Appalachia, you know, where we have that other horrendous case, right? You know, so you're going to have the divergence in this, but where it can help is that village mentality and also getting rid of the stigma. The hardest thing, especially of our generation, of the Gen Xers getting older, we don't ask for help. We think we got it all, especially when you're dealing with a mom that's a type A hard charger, trying to hold it all together, wants a big family, wants to be able to be the labor and delivery nurse, wants to be the great wife, wants to be the great mother, and wants to have more kids. You know, that is the go, 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 go. And so getting rid of the stigma that it's okay to ask for help, and she was, it's nothing to do this with her, but other people. And just recognize that, hey, if the system's failing, we all got to come together. And here's the red flags we saw because of this case. And here's what we're going to do differently because of this case. You know, we're going to get you away from the kids. We're going to get you some better help. We're going to go to other people that can actually centralize the diagnosis, centralize your medication, centralize everything, and demand it. And here's what people also fall into in the world of mental health and just our healthcare system all overall. We relinquish control thinking these people are experts, but you are the customer. Never forget you're the customer. If you are not getting the service you want, you demand something different or go someplace else with your money and your health insurance money if you have it.
Yeah. Advocating for oneself is more important than ever. And in no way, I know people are like, well, she should have done this. She's a labor and delivery nurse.
No, she did everything.
She did everything. She did advocate for herself, and the system still failed. There's only so much advocating one can do. But honest to God, I mean, that is so true for anything. I've learned in the last 10, 20 years, I feel like, and you just need to do more and more and more of it, because relying on the system, quote unquote, to do its job is something no one should ever do. Now, it would be great if our systems did do it most of the time and we didn't have to double check everything, but the reality is it's broken. So many are broken.
I think Massachusetts will get better after this, but
maybe.
Maybe.
It seems that since 1692, they pretty much treat women's mental health the same way. I don't anticipate a massive shift anytime soon, but who knows? Another element of this, the fear of the med changes and lack of sleep. I have been with somebody who was going through postpartum. I know other people, but I mean, I've seen it firsthand. The biggest fear, the biggest anxiety, the biggest piece in my world that I saw with someone who went through it that was so hard to watch was the fear of not getting enough sleep and the fear of changing a med, because the changing of the med can affect the sleep so much, and it ends up being a cycle that so many women go through when they're in postpartum. I know that what I went through was not unique. But it is, if you've never been there, to see it. But that cycle is so common in situations like this. And it is extremely debilitating. And I don't think it gets enough attention and understanding of that vicious cycle of adjusting those meds and not getting sleep and the effects of not getting the sleep and the effects of not getting the right meds, or the adjusting to the side effects of the meds that kick in right away until the actual benefits of the meds kick in 6 weeks later. There's so many things at play here that are beyond the control of the brain of the person taking them. And this prosecution is telling a jury that person who's consuming all of this, that they're 100% in control. And if you think all the shit that we're putting into their brain that changes it has anything to do with it, well, that's just witchery. And that's where I have to walk away from this case, because it's insane.
Yeah. And there's one more thing on it too, Tony. And that is, she was extremely healthy as well. She's a runner. She's fitness oriented. She had her little gym downstairs in a basement, and which makes her even more highly attuned to changes in her body. And my own firsthand experience and many other people's firsthand experience, when you have shit that starts going sideways in your brain where you feel out of control, whether it's because you have insomnia or you're or you're, you know, you're feeling depressed or you have anxiety, not just a word or a fleeting emotion, but seriously, you all of a sudden feel like you're not in control of your brain in any way whatsoever, even as something as light as that, it is absolutely terrifying. Yeah. Because your brain is like doing things that you are not telling it not to do, and it's doing it anyway. And what a psychotic break is, it takes it beyond what anyone can even imagine if you've never been through it yourself. That's why it's so hard for everyone to fathom, because not being in control of what your brain is saying and thinking or your actions because of what it's telling you is terrifying, and we can't absorb it.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to work our way through this case. And if you want access every day to the trial coverage, we got it for you on our podcast channel on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, wherever you get podcasts. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and press subscribe. Let's go over to another case that's going on right now, 30 years in the making. Tupac. Tupac Shakur was shot at a red light in Las Vegas at Cobalt and Flamingo. And I've pointed that out every time I've driven through that intersection. You know what happened right here, right? And whoever's in the car, it's like, what? I'm like, Tupac. And there's a little memorial by one of the lights there that still is there to this day that people put things at. I drove it this spring, fall, I was over in Vegas not that long ago, and I got to point it out to my daughter as we drove by Colby.
Who said, who, what, where, when?
Yeah, and Harper knew Tupac. Anyway, 30 years ago, Cobalt and Flamingo, after the Mike Tyson fight, for three decades, nobody ever charged in the murder of Tupac. Now there's one man sitting in the courtroom, Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, and the prosecution's best evidence is that book that he wrote. Talking about it. He bragged about it for years on camera, in interviews, in a memoir called Compton Street Legend. And now that he's actually on trial for murder, his defense is telling the jury it was all fiction, all lies. He just did it for profit. He became the I killed Tupac industry. The question the audience is screaming is the one the jury has to answer. Can the man talk himself out of a murder charge that he's already admitted that he's guilty of? That's where this case is at. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, my co-host with us as we discuss this. It can be any case, really. This guy literally wrote a book about it. He went on YouTube, on Vlad TV, a big hip-hop show, talked about it. He told law enforcement about it through a proffer agreement. And now his lawyer is standing in front of a jury saying it was all fiction. It was all a big old lie. Robin, from an FBI perspective, from a behavioral perspective, when someone confesses to the same crime in four different formats over 30 years, is there any version of that where it's not real?
Possibly.
Yeah.
Living in the world of maybe. So having written four books and fictionalized stories in those things, because I have to protect the national security of the United States and our sources, methods, and allies, I understand the fictionalizing of things, although they're all based in core truths and outcomes and things like that. So I understand what publishers do, trying to get a better story out of things. They're going to sell more millions of books so they can make a profit off of you. So they're not really vested in your success as much as they're vested in their own. So I get that. I researched this as well. Books are often very commonly used as evidence in cases, and they can be used against you. What's going to be hard for him to overcome, if he can even overcome it as well, is not the statements, because people make false confessions all the time. He can claim that those are fiction for selling books, and it sells a great story. But if law enforcement can go back and corroborate all the things that he says in that book, the timelines, and show the corroboration between real life evidence and the storyline in the book, and they overlap completely, that's a very, very hard thing to overcome. Because again, what you're showing is his book outlines his life arc. Mm-hmm. And that's what we talk about all the time. And then if his life arc, that's supposedly in his book, which is a nonfiction memoir, and he now claims it's a fiction memoir, but actually the real life investigators can show that the real life arc, backed by forensic evidence, backed by interviews, backed by all the data they've collected over the years, matches that memoir. That's a very, very difficult thing to overcome if you can even do it.
Well, and the premise of this all is it starts with an agreement with investigators over the murder of Biggie, actually. Mm-hmm. The notorious B.I.G., Christopher Wallace, which happened within a year of Tupac's murder. And he was testifying about information regarding that case. And in that testimony, which is called a proffer agreement, and Eric has said it here. Bob has said it here. They don't advise a lot of clients to ever do it because they're very shady, if you will, these agreements with law enforcement. Sometimes they're not in writing. Sometimes they're just verbal. Sometimes right. they're the only way you're going to get off the hook for something. So either take this or we're going to lock you up. So people take the chance because it's better than the alternative. They're not the most solid ground to be walking on. Keefe D, basically the way this story goes is, took the proffer agreement, talked about being in the car, not being the trigger man. Orlando Anderson allegedly was a trigger man, but he's the one who was a shot caller, baller, 20-inch blaze, owned an Impala, called a get late tonight. I mean, okay, you don't know that song, but Todd. Nah. he's basically the shot caller here in this thing. And he's arguing that, okay, I said it for this to help this investigation under this proffer agreement. I can't go and share this story now. I can't write a book about it. I can't talk about it in interviews. The government is saying, no, you can't. That was just for this, but we never really gave you the stipulations of what you could and couldn't do either. So now we're coming after you because you violated this unsaid agreement kind of that we had here. But it was his choice. It was his choice to not just let it die there with the one-on-one private conversation with investigators. He openly chose to basically make it his brand, make it what he's known for. This is his legend. He was the one in the car that gave Orlando the gun, that called the shots, and yep. then profited it off of the story for 20 years. It's a hard one to overcome, considering that's your story, unless you're just going to come out and say you're a complete fraud, which is basically what he's doing at this point in time. Here's a comment from one of our channels. Everybody else who was in that white Cadillac is dead.
Yep.
Orlando Anderson is dead. The two other passengers dead. Keefe D is the only one alive. How do you prosecute a 30-year-old murder when your defendant is both the only suspect and the only witness that is still alive? Yeah, that's difficult. But yeah. I think you do when the guy wrote books about it and did interviews.
Yeah,
and he shut up. You'd have a lot harder case.
That's it. You know, if you wrote about it. And again, if he was in a different state when he did this, it might be something different because, he wasn't the trigger man. He doesn't claim he's a trigger man, but it's in Nevada, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Yes.
The law there is that if you were the one who orchestrated it and facilitated it, you can be charged with the same murder of it. So had he done this in some other state, he might have been getting free with it. I'm actually pretty impressed that the law enforcement actually got a hair up their butt and did something about this case 30 years later. So I'm more, you know, it's interesting with things like this. I get really curious about the people involved. It's like, what inspired them to want to do that? Because they're kind of putting themselves out there. When you start dealing with old gang members and gang leaders, you know, you're kind of putting yourself in an interesting spot in life.
Well, I mean, one of the biggest problems with this case has always been no snitching and people not talking. I mean, there's been investigators on this case forever, and there's been many documentaries about it. And essentially where it all ends is, well, the people who did know information or could provide information have chosen not to provide information. And that kind of puts the investigation at a standstill. They can only be as good as the information that's being provided and what they can actually get to. Suge Knight was in the car with Tupac when it happened. He survived. He's sitting in prison right now and reportedly won't cooperate with the trial.
Right.
If the one living witness on the victim's side won't testify, what does that tell you about how this world actually works, and does it matter for the actual verdict? The people involved here, I don't think really have much of a vested interest in justice, the way that the rest of society looks at justice, meaning locking someone up for this crime. Most of this just gets handled in the street. And 30 years later, It's already been handled in the street. Everyone else is dead at this point.
Right. And snitches get stitches. That's why he's not talking in prison, because he's still there. You know, I go on the pragmatic side of these things behind the scenes about how the sausage is made, as Bob Mata says.
Yeah.
Looking at the motivations for taking this case on and reinvigorating it after 30 years, one, you want justice done. You know, on an altruistic side, on our side, we're saying, oh, wow, you know, some really diligent investigators, you know, said we have to have served justice here and everything. But remember, there's a lot of cases that are unsolved you can be served justice on. You know, believe it or not, I would put money on the bet that at some point there's someone inside an administration somewhere out in Las Vegas that says, hey, we need some attention, we need some funding, we need some collars, we need an easier low-hanging fruit one that we can attack to bring attention to this, because we need a resource here, we need to have more detectives of this, so we need to be able to justify it. There's all kind of things going on behind the scenes that typically people never see, that I've seen extensively, that would also give added motivation to re-go at this case. But when you don't have any witnesses willing to talk, you know, we've had such amazing advancements in law enforcement. Even just listen to the great Bob Mata's Gacy file case called Buried. He talks about, you know, the things they had available to them in the 70s for law enforcement investigators compared to now. It's vastly different. And so even when this happened to now, the DNA evidence that might be available and all other forensic analysis that's available now that wasn't available then could be added to this case. But again, the book itself and being able to then corroborate timelines from other investigative techniques that are available to us now that weren't available then might have been a reason why they took another swing at this. And it's got a strong chance, I think, just because of that book.
I think it became such low-hanging fruit that they couldn't do it.
Yeah.
That they couldn't not go after this at some point, because it sat there forever. And you literally had the person who's claiming they are the shot caller on this going on interviews all the time. It was like one a year you're finding Keefe D on, basically talking about the same story about him. I mean, and it's like, Jesus. Like, I remember watching them going, like, he's like literally admitting to this crime. Like, how is he not going to be charged with this? Surprise. At some point, when you tempt fate by throwing that out there so many ways, they're going to come after you. I mean, I think if he had just shut up, we wouldn't be here. None of this would be going on.
Yeah.
And I mean, his proffer agreement would have stood, but he decided that he was going to make this a brand, and his ego, as twisted as it is, to think that, well, this is what I want to be known for. This is my legacy. That's an interesting one to like want to be going down with. Was more important than his freedom. And I think he thought that he was above it. Because talk about confirmation bias here. He had basically 30 years of freedom, being able to go out there and scream from the top of the hills, I was involved in the shooting of Tupac, and nobody came for him until they did.
And only in the last about 10 years from my research did he kind of turn a leaf over from what he was doing. But so here's an interesting little factoid, Tony, that we've talked about in other cases. Did you know the head of the department that is investigating this case is Steve Wolfson, the Clark County District Attorney? Did you know his current term ends on January 4th, 2027, and he's running for re-election? And that the current election is scheduled for November 3rd, 2026? I wonder if someone wanted a little bit more notoriety of being able to bring a big case to bear before his election.
And interesting timing that this has been delayed so many times, right up to the butting up to the election itself.
Yeah. Look at me.
Wonder what that's about.
When you always got to look at intent and motivations behind absolutely everything. When something stands out and is a big wobble and a deviation from what you'd normally expect, and so something that's been dead for 30 years all of a sudden gets resurrected, you just don't look at the people themselves, you know, the perpetrator, the accused, and those in a circle. You look at absolutely everyone involved to see what you can discern from the intent, because that helps us predict behaviors, helps us understand what's going on, and then look for wobbles other places. For me, this begs the question, when you see someone going after an old case like this, all right, so who's bored? There's any other cases going on in Las Vegas of murders?
Yeah, it's not like there's a shortage of them there, really.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's that's very true. And there's so many cases there. That's like kind of the missing link as to why is this happening now? Just take
not
a
saying
look
it's at- not saying it's not righteous, but there's a lot of other things. And if you're looking at a reason why, well, there's one more big wobble.
You can be righteous, but also have incentives simultaneously.
Yes.
But I guess the question is more like what came, you know, with the chicken before the egg? Are you doing it for the righteous reasons? And then this just happens to be the added value to it? Or is it, I need this added value. What's something righteous I can get myself involved in? Either way, if it reaches the truth at the end of the day, I'm cool with it.
Absolutely.
But only if it's truly going to go in the direction of reaching the truth. And we shall see. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversation right there. One more case to talk about as we continue to break down all these three big trials that are going on right now. Jared Breidigan was a 30-year-old father of four, Microsoft engineer, devout member of his church on February 16th of 2022. He dropped his twins off at his ex-wife Shanna Gardner's house, and on the drive home with his 2-year-old daughter Brexley strapped in the back seat, he stopped to move a tire out of the road, a tire the prosecutors say was put there on purpose. He was shot and killed while his daughter sat 10 feet away in her car seat. Now the man accused of hiring the shooter is on trial. The ex-wife's trial starts in about 3 weeks, directly at the end of this one, and the admitted gunman just withdrew his guilty plea and says, none of it's true. All this stuff I said, you know, they hired me. I'm a witness for the state. He withdrew that. He's going to be on trial now, too. The audience wants to know one thing. Who is telling the truth and who is trying to survive? We're going to do some Q&A with your questions that you've dropped in the comment section. If you got some right now, drop them. We'll try to get to them. Robin Dreek and myself breaking it down. The current or one of our first questions here. The prosecution says the only connection between the shooter, Henry Tenen, and Jared Breidigan is Mario Fernandez. That's a powerful statement, but the defense is showing video of Tenen doing actual work, tilling, tree removal, landscaping at Fernandez's property. How does a jury decide whether $10,000 in checks was payment for contract work or payment for a murder? And let me just set this up a little bit for the audience to understand if you're not familiar with this. Yep. Tenen, Henry Tenen, the alleged trigger man here, who already came out to law enforcement and admitted guilt, but has now withdrawn that and now wants a trial, is the originally said, yes, they hired me to do it. He was a tenant of Fernandez, of homes that he owned. And he had been allegedly doing some work for him, some groundwork, things like that, that would require payment. And shortly after the murder, he started getting checks from Fernandez that ended up totaling about $10,000. The checks had notes that corresponded with labor work. One of them even said, Kickstarter, good luck. Again, totaling $10,000. Tenen saying, yeah, it's for the actual work. It's not for a murder. See, the check note says it. As if that's just the end thing. Tenen's DNA was found on the tire that was rolled out in the road. He's associated with the truck that was there. And the only connection between Tenen and the dead guy, Jared Breidigan, is Fernandez, mm-hmm. who's the ex-husband of Jared Breidigan, the dead guy in this case, married to Shannon Gardner. So it certainly looks... It looks like there's a bit of a connection with new husband of the wife, mother of these kids, and the death of Jared Breidigan through Tenen. So what's your thoughts on that, Robin, now that we kind of have that in place? See, it can't possibly be for murder because the check memo says it was for a Kickstarter. Good luck.
So it was because he admitted it.
Oh, there's that.
Yeah. So I looked at the background of all these people again. We covered this case a while ago, and so I had to refresh my memory. We had a run for a while of murder for hires because murder for hires are pretty typical that it's generally caused by a child custody issue, which is exactly the case here.
Yep.
So this young couple got married. They're both LDS members, Latter-day Saint Mormons.
Go figure another one.
Yeah. They got married after about 3 months of knowing each other. They had twins together. One of the twins had a lot of medical issues, so they moved around the country a bit. So they eventually wind up in Florida. They then get divorced, very contentious, child custody issue. the wife leaves the religious side aside. She meets this guy, Mario, who is former army, gets discharged with an other than honorable. I'm looking at he basically was charged but not convicted of a sexual assault inside the army as a drill sergeant, not drill instructor. Those are Marines. Yeah. So he gets out. So you can see we got an arc of some unsavory behavior from Mario. They get married as a convenience, apparently, as an arrangement so that she could battle for the children, and he was playing the role of father for them. So that's what this entanglement happened. And so the ex-husband is battling for the kids, and so this guy, Tenen, comes in, who's also got a horrendous criminal record, and he then gets hired, supposedly, by Mario Fernandez, the new husband, to take out the ex-husband.
Yeah.
So here's what's interesting. He admits it originally as part of a plea deal, and the plea deal was, I think, he's going to serve like 10 years in prison for.
Yeah. He took the plea deal.
Right.
Agreed to testify against Fernandez and Gardner, right. And then earlier this year, walked into court and looked at the judge and said, "I want a trial."
And here's why. Here's my conjecture on this one. Like we just said a few minutes ago on the Tupac case, snitches get stitches. So he's weighing his odds here, right? So no matter whether he goes to trial or he takes a plea deal, either way, he's going in the clink. And he's going to be either the guy who snitched out someone behind bars or the guy who didn't snitch out the guy behind bars. And so he's weighing his odds because, you know, this is a smart guy.
Yeah, he looks it.
And so I just think he's like, well, what do I got to lose, man? I can at least swing for the fences here. I'll throw everyone under the bus and see what happens.
Robin, I get, is that your take on this? Because that's going to be my next question, is why change your testimony?
I mean,
he got a pretty sweet deal for murdering someone.
But still behind bars, though.
And it's clear as day that he's going to be behind bars either way, one right. for less amount of time, one for basically eternity. He's trading in the lesser amount of time for eternity to essentially protect the two of them. I don't understand this. Or is Tenen looking at reality going, I maybe have 10, 15 years left in me. That's about the time I'm going to be incarcerated for.
Yep.
I don't want to be the snitch behind bars.
Yep.
So is that it? Is that the motivating? Is that the inspiration that you think made him change his idea or his story on what he wants the courts to believe?
I put it at 95 to 98 or maybe 99%. Remember, so it's sometimes it's hard for us and we overcomplicate things because our listeners, ourselves, we're very empathetic people. And we might do something empathetic to take care of someone else. You really think this scumbag, dirtbag is actually thinking of the well-being of these two people?
No, that's
himself?
Why it didn't make any sense to me. Like, why is he doing this?
Self-preservation. I took a look at the odds on this, and I said to myself, you know, again, reverse the situation, put yourself in the shoes. What would inspire me to change my tune like this? And then you just look at the facts and details behind it. It's like, wow. Regardless of what I do, I'm going to be behind bars. Now, what's being behind bars in general population look like if I do this or if I do this? And if you're going to be behind bars from 10 years or for the rest of your life, what do you want that to look like? What's it going to look like? What's a guarantee of what it looks like if you are, one, the hitman for, in other words, the mope that was hired by someone to kill a father, and then you snitched and gave up the father and the wife to do it, or you're just the guy behind bars because when they show up, the first thing that cell block does is you got to present your papers, you know, what are you in here for, and everyone behind bars knows what they're in there for. They know if they're a cooperator or not a cooperator. I think he's hedging his bets on the best life he can possibly get behind bars since he's going there no matter what.
I didn't even consider it that way, but that does make a lot of sense.
Remember, remember, human beings will always act in what they think is their best interest. It sometimes is very complicated to figure out what they think their best interests are, but in times when you're dealing with idiots, which is 99% of the people we deal with in the world of true crime, their best interest is, how can I have the least amount of pain inflicted on me? This is it.
And that's true. I mean, and it comes down to really like your understanding of the systems. I've never been in the prison system. I only understand it from the viewpoint of an understanding of how we talk about it here. And I do know the you know, snitches get stitches, you know, way that that works. But oftentimes, I think a lot of us, at least I do, incorrectly, think, well, if it's connected to that case, if there's somebody else behind bars that's somehow connected that's going to get back at you. It doesn't, it's not about that. It's just about, it's about your moral standing, about your character. If you're someone who snitched in your own case and you get behind bars, they're going to judge you for the decisions of which you made within your own case. And if you snitched in that case, well, guess what? They're going to look at you as, well, this is what this person does. And yeah, that would make a lot of sense as to why he's making that change.
And now that is based on the data I have today. Yeah. Living in the world of maybe, that is the only reasonable explanation I can come up with about, because again, people act in their own best interest. He wants to feel safe. What's the best way he can feel safe since he's going to be behind bars no matter what? Mm-hmm. What's the best way he can go behind bars and feel safe?
There is a bit of a twist, a bombshell maybe, to the case. The prosecutor saying that Tenen was not alone the night of the shooting. Someone allegedly fled on foot and someone else drove a truck away from the scene. If there's a fourth person involved who hasn't been charged, how does that change the entire case? That's one of the questions we got on YouTube. Well, I mean, I guess it can put, I don't know if it injects reasonable doubt, but it certainly injects, well, who else was involved? Tenen's DNA is on, you know, it's there.
Everything.
It's on the tire. It's on everything.
It's in the truck.
Yeah, there's not a lot of debate over whether he was there and involved. Yeah, it's more so who else was involved, and I guess why haven't we found them? When you have a mystery perpetrator in this, you got one guy who's involved, but they're treating this as if no one else was involved other than we know someone else ran away from the scene, but our investigation wasn't good enough to get us there. I'm wondering how that'll play in front of a jury. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's part of the calculation that Tenen made. So he gets a new attorney because he also said he wasn't served well by his attorney that advised him to take the plea deal, and he found that the plea deal sucked, and so he didn't want to do the plea deal. Again, I think it goes back to the fact that the plea deal said you're going behind bars, and his new attorney probably said, well, if we can actually sow some reasonable doubt in the jury and I can make some challenges of suppression of some evidence here and there, you actually not only have a better chance if you go behind bars because you're no longer a snitch, but there's a chance, higher chance than otherwise if you pled guilty, that I might be able to get you off. So I think reasonable doubt might come into play for this because there now, would Tenen give anyone else up? No, we're not going to do that because again, snitches get stitches, but allowing that theory to float out there and even given evidence to support the theory without actually directly corroborating it himself through testimony, I would do it.
It's going to be interesting. Shanna's attorney is Jose Baez, very well-known attorney, very successful attorney, one that's not going to take on cases that I think he thinks he's got a good chance at losing. Shanna's is a different case than Mario's, and we're going to get to that right after this trial wraps up. But that's, I mean, that's a big bet to make, arguing that I can prove that she had nothing to do with it, or that Mario, I mean, he's not representing her, but essentially, I mean, the cases are very intertwined. But the defense is basically arguing, you know, Fernandez is just a guy who hired a handyman. The prosecution is arguing he's a man who hired a hitman. Same check, same phone call, same relationship, two completely different stories on what happened here. And both can look identical, from the outside looking in. But that connection, you'd have to believe that for some reason, a tenant of Shanna's new husband, Mario, for some reason decided, I want to go murder the ex-husband of Shanna by putting a tire in the road and being involved in that just for no reason at all.
Right.
With no egging on by them, no agreement with them, no asking of them, just one day, I'm going to go kill that guy. Why not? That's what kills it, I think, for anybody is, of course, you guys are involved. But is there a world? Is there a world where the 10,000 foot overview of, these checks say it's for Kickstarter and lawn work, not for murder? And I guess, you know, he might have done lawn work and he might have had a Kickstarter, which maybe that money was technically for. But at the same point, you're suddenly getting it maybe for some other reason. I mean, is there a world where that equates to reasonable doubt inside a reasonable jury?
Again, it comes down to the lawyers and how good they are presenting it, what gets suppressed and what doesn't get suppressed. It's in this case, I think it's a real stretch because you have a timeline, because you have a lot of DNA that shows Tenon at the site, the connection between the two. And then it comes down to what's the gain? So you say that, you know, they're saying $10,000 for lawn work, but he's not connected to this other thing. And even if... there's always an intent to gain something from an action you take. And so if not Tenon, then who? I mean, there's no one actually fits the bill. You could actually say Fernandez was there doing it, but that doesn't really quite fit with the timeline, with the cell phone data, and see what I mean? And also the video evidence up apparently, because the clothes he was wearing was captured on video surveillance camera as well. The clothes, the gait, the walk, everything matched Tenon. I mean, there's a lot of evidence against Tenon on this. And to claim it's not him and that the money was meant for this other thing, well, then what did you do it for to begin with? See what I mean? There's such a disconnect between that. There's got to be a motivation to take the action of X, Y, and Z. It's a rough one to.
Does it ever surprise you when you see what people do in an effort to conceal or cover something up and what they think is just airtight? Like, let me just write this memo on this check. It says Kickstarter. Good luck. That'll keep them off our tracks. And it's just, I mean, it's so surface. It's so stupid. It's so disprovable. But when they're writing it, they're thinking, damn, we're good.
I mean, yeah. And it's not just they think, damn, they're good. Remember, we say this multiple times in the last couple of days, especially when dealing with the Lindsey Clancy case, and that is when you're in the rainstorm, all you see is rain, and you think the entire world is raining. Meanwhile, you take one step this way, and you got sunshine and blue skies, right? And so in this case here, you're thinking, everyone hates this guy. You know, no one's going to pay attention if he's gone. All I got to do is come up with a simple little explanation. They'll blow it off because no one really gives a rat's ass because I don't care. My ex-wife-to-be doesn't care because they're actually in the middle of separating at the time. And this mope that is a lifelong criminal anyway, he's not going to care. So when you're living in a small little microcosm, that 3-5-person confab, you think it's the entire universe. You think that mindset is going to be everyone's mindset. Meanwhile, you take one half step out of there, you just offed a father that's beloved by his family, by his children, and an entire world gets up, you know, in an uprage about it because you're actually the nutter when you actually thought the rest of the world was victimizing you.
Yeah, it's amazing how when one is only living in their bubble, how much they don't see of what's going on outside of it.
That's why we have living critics, you know, loving critics, because they're the objective people for us. But if your loving critic is inside your Nutterville, you're doomed.
Exactly. Exactly. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts tomorrow. Eric Faddis is going to be with us. We're going to be going over a lot of these cases as well from a legal standpoint, from the prospect or from the viewpoint of a former prosecutor and a defense attorney. So join us tomorrow, 11 Central, for that. Be sure to check out Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books and audiobooks. Leave Please a review do. On Amazon. That is much appreciated. And that'll wrap up today's episode. Give us your thoughts, like I said, in the comments section. Until next time, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon. Peace.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.